the fifth kind.
I've been a preacher for more than 30 years. I've studied and taught through the book of Genesis many, many times in churches all around the world. And I've trained pastors in the skills of interpreting text. You translate Elohim in the plural, it all makes sense that what we actually have is a conflict among the sky people, among the powerful ones, over how intelligent the human species is to be.
We've read stories of brutal colonization and ill treatment of human beings as a story of God and God's behavior. We've come up with a picture of God that is completely distorted. The Apostle Paul described God as the source of the cosmos and everything in it, that in which we all live and move and have our being. You go to the mistranslation of the Elohim stories and you've got a God who's brutal, violent, can genocide people, will slaughter people who are actually trying to serve him. It's a monstrous deity we've created by mistranslation. And you can draw a straight line from that to all kinds of violence and abuses that we've justified in the name of God. And that comes down to mistranslation. When I talk about Bible translation, people might say, well, that's a bit of a rarefied topic, isn't it? But the implications of getting it wrong are enormous, and they have been through the ages. As I've studied theology and world mythology, I've realized that dragons occur in ancestral narratives all around the world. You go to Egypt, and their dragon was Akek. And then in Mesoamerica, you've got Quetzalcoatl, Cucumatz, Kukulcan. In Georgia, you've got the Colchis. In Portugal and Spain, you've got the Coca. You've got the Cuchedra, the Ikuchi, the Curuchu. The shape of the stories is very similar from culture to culture. And they talk about a time when our ancestors were ruled over by entities that were not human. They are reptilian, they destroy people using fire, and they use the humans as their workforce to supply them with.
Author and researcher Paul Wallace probes the world's ancient mythologies for clues about the origins of the human race and has published several books in the field of mysticism and spirituality. In the last decade, his work has probed the world's ancient mythologies for the insights they hold on our origins as a species and our potential as human beings. Paul's work in church ministry has included training pastors in the interpretation of biblical texts, working as a troubleshooter for communities of faith, and serving as an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia.
Endorsed by George Norrie and Eric von Daniken, Paul Wallace's latest book, Echoes of Eden, explores what secrets of human potential were buried with our ancestors' memories of ET contact. From Senate briefings in Washington, D.C., to secret ceremonies in Southern Africa, from strange phenomena in Australia and Iraq, to mysterious encounters in modern Brazil and ancient Greece. Echoes of Eden will take you around the globe to discover why military, intelligence, and other government agencies are so interested in archaeology, indigenous rituals, and traditional initiation practices. What is the connection between higher cognitive powers like remote viewing and precognition and ET contact in the deep past? And what are the implications for us today? Echoes of Eden, out now. Available on Amazon. Follow the links in the description.
Go to www.paulanthonywallace.com for information about Paul and his books.
We've had 2,000 years in which the question of ET contact, paleo contact, a populated universe have been completely taboo. In the beginning of Christianity, it was not. There were very significant church fathers who taught what I'm teaching in my Eden series and believed in a populated universe, also believed that our development as a species was aided by interventions from ET demographics. They read the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, through that lens,
And they had learnt that from Plato, who was writing nearly half a millennium before Christianity. So when Christianity began, it was a kaleidoscope of experiences and ideas and theologies, and it included this narrative of ancient ET contact. Unfortunately, as the Roman Empire hijacked Christianity and morphed it into the Department of Religion, the Imperial Department of Religion, it silenced some of these more interesting narratives, and it narrowed Christianity down to this orthodoxy with God and the emperor at the top, the bishops and the senators in the middle, and then the priests and the people at the bottom, praying and obeying. And some of these more empowering texts that spoke about these more interesting phenomena were excluded from the canon. And it became such a hostile environment for those kinds of views that not only were key church fathers anathematized, excommunicated, their work destroyed so that we have no record of some of the writing of these key people, but some of these key documents were literally buried in the desert to protect them from destruction, so that information about paleocontact, for instance, and higher cognitive powers would survive for a later generation. And from that time to this, it is just known this is a taboo. We don't talk about these things. And I think I was very fortunate that I did the research that led to the Eden series when I was not leading a congregation. If I'd been leading a congregation and doing that research, I don't think I could have published, because it would have split my congregation in two. Half the people would have read the Eden books and said, oh, thank you so much for putting this on the table, because I've seen this in the Bible too, or because I've had these close encounter experiences and finally we can talk about it. But the other half of the congregation would say, Pastor, this is heresy. You can't stay here. So I was very fortunate not to have those obligations and to have the freedom to follow where the data led. But the power of taboo is very strong, and it's not just happened within the churches. Our governments had official policies of debunking the UFO and ET contact phenomena for best part of 70 years. We have been culturally habituated to laughing at people who describe close encounters or abduction experiences, and it's only really in the last 3 years that that policy has changed in the US, with the Pentagon finally coming forward and authenticating the UFO phenomenon. And that led last year to the Senate briefings. So I hope there's a bit of a culture shift happening right now. Certainly, we're hearing from authorities on the subject of contemporary ET contact in a way that we never have before in my lifetime. So we have people like Haim Eshed, the former chief of space security for Israel. He was the brigadier general, held that position for 27 years. He can come forward, as he did a couple of Christmases ago, and say that on the basis of his work, his belief is that we are already in contact with a number of spacefaring civilizations who make up what he called an intergalactic federation. And we've been in contact for some time, but they've chosen not to self-disclose until we have a better understanding of space. Now, in years past, you would never hear anything like that from someone in authority like him, and nobody above him came in and debunked him. And he's just one example. We've heard from Alain Juillet, the French security chief, who has authenticated the work of ATIP as investigating metamaterials retrieved from UFO crashes. And so he has endorsed what Luis Elizondo has said, who headed up that unit within the Pentagon for 10 years. All this is coming out. The Pentagon has authenticated the footage we've all seen of the Tic Tac encounters from 2004. The USS Nimitz engaged to follow these incredible, well, UFOs, to use the old-fashioned name. And look, there are other senior figures around the world speaking about these things and not being debunked, which is new. So there has been a culture shift, but there is still this bias towards ridicule when people talk about UFOs, ET contact, abduction phenomena. But I hope that with my books, we're making it more a part of mainstream conversation again, and more people are opening up to these topics. I remember as a little boy growing up in England watching a children's cartoon called Noggin the Nog. And it was stories from out of the Dark Ages. And there was a Welsh dragon in it, a Welsh griffin called Idris. And so I grew up thinking that the dragon stories were a Welsh phenomenon. And then as I've studied theology and world mythology, I've realized, of course, that dragons occur in ancestral narratives all around the world. And one of the things that's curious about it is the names of them. So you go to Egypt, and their dragon was Akek. And then in Mesoamerica, you've got Quetzalcoatl, Cucumatz, Kukulcan. In Georgia, you've got the Colchis. In Portugal and Spain, you've got the Coca. You've got the Cuchedra, the Ikuchi, the Curuchu. And I don't know if you spotted, but there is a phonetic similarity across all those names. Why is that? And for me, this is a clue that these stories all around the world might be curating the memory of the same sound. Or maybe even the same proper name. And in Echoes of Eden, I show that there is a very strong relationship between those stories and some of the Yahweh stories of the Hebrew canon. Now, Yahweh, that name might sound a million miles away from the k-k names of other cultures. In Echoes of Eden, I show, linguistically, it's exactly the same. But why are the stories there? Are they there just to teach a moral, or are they curating the memory of an entity that made a particular sound or had a particular name? The shape of the stories is very similar from culture to culture. And they talk about a time when our ancestors were ruled over by entities that were not human. And there's something very specific about them. They are reptilian. They destroy people using fire. And they use the humans as their workforce to supply them with cattle, gold, and virgin girls. That's what dragons want all around the world, apparently. And then, thankfully, the story doesn't end there. We reach a point where the dragons go and the humans govern themselves. But something happens first. The humans reach a point of exhaustion, where they say, we are not going to continue serving these draconian entities. And they come together and they realize that if they act with solidarity and just say no to this pattern of governance, it won't work. When the humans say, what if we all come together and we all say no, what's the dragon going to do? Not going to kill all of us, otherwise it'll have no one to work for it. Might kill some of us, but its power will be at an end. And that's how the stories go. The people come together, the dragon is defeated and goes off into the mountains or disappears altogether. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that same pattern is there in the Bible. There's a long period where the human colonies are governed over by non-human, draconian, reptilian entities. And then the people, this is 1 Samuel 8, say, we're not going to have this anymore. We want human governance for human society. We're not going to serve this draconian entity anymore. And the shift is made. It follows the Egyptian pattern. It follows the Georgian pattern, the Welsh pattern. The stories all around the world record this time. Now, is that the memory of a kind of entity that's reptilian? I think there's every reason to take that seriously, because not only do you have the audio memory, but the physical descriptors repeat all around the world. People associate feathered reptilians with the Mesoamerican stories of Kukulcan, Quetzalcoatl, Cucumatz. But in fact, it's there in the Bible as well. The skin is described. The snout is described. The flight feathers are described. These really were totally different entities.
In the book of 2 Samuel, King David describes Yahweh like this. In my distress, I called out to Yahweh. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came to his ears. The earth trembled and quaked. The foundations of the skies shook. They trembled because he was angry. Smoke rose from his nostrils. Consuming fire came from his mouth. Burning coals blazed out of it. He parted the skies and came down with dark clouds of smoke under his feet. He mounted the cherubim and flew, soaring on the wings of the wind. Bolts of lightning blazed forth, the valleys of the sea were exposed, and the foundations of the earth laid bare, at the rebuke of Yahweh, at the blast of breath from his nostrils. Multiple texts in the Hebrew canon speak of Yahweh's wings and pinions, and in almost every text where the nostrils of Yahweh are mentioned in the Bible, the length of the nostrils is mentioned, and almost invariably, destruction by fire quickly follows.
Now, some people might say, some of these dragon stories sound more like technology to me. So you go to the Toltec stories or the Olmec stories, and some of those texts, or into the Popol Vuh, some of those texts really do sound like ancient technology being described and described in draconian terms. So if you've got an entity that's got metal skin and is covered in lights and that flies through the sky with a fire trail brighter than the moon in the night sky, well, I think to the modern reader, we think, I think I know what I'm looking at there. But there are other texts where the biological nature of these draconian beings is very, very clear. So right across the board of the dragon stories, I think if we bring our contemporary frameworks to them, it's not hard to recognize we're talking about extraterrestrial beings and extraterrestrial technology.
You've recently been in contact with best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded translator Mauro Biligno.
Mauro Biligno is a scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for the St. Paul Press in Rome, translating with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. Providing the interlinear meaning is a very exact discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part.
So when you hear academics like Mauro coming to the same conclusions, do you think that people will start to take this translation work more seriously?
Well, I certainly think it is interesting when different writers on the basis of different research are coming to very similar conclusions. And I certainly found it encouraging when I had written Escaping from Eden to discover Mauro's work and realize he'd come to very similar conclusions to me and from such a solid basis in Bible translation. His work was producing the interlinear renditions of the Hebrew for interlinear Bibles, Vatican-approved Bibles. So it's a very exacting skill that he had. And so I think, yes, it's interesting when there's that agreement. But people can be very sniffy about academic credentials. And very often it's the work of the writer to push the conversation forward, because those in tenured positions who are at the top of the academic tree tend to be conservatized by the process of peer review. It's not very often that a tenured academic will come out and say, all my colleagues in my own university and in the university world are quite wrong, and I've discovered the correct version of things. Tends not to happen because they're going to get piled on by all their colleagues rubbishing what they're saying. Peer review is important, but it is a conservatizing energy, and very often it's popular writers who will join the dots of the academic work and say, hold on, aren't the implications of that this? They put it on the table, and then that enables the conversation to move forward, because then the academics can say, we should discuss what this crazy writer's written in this crazy book,
And then they can have a conversation and say, well, he may have a point here, or he may have a point there. And so the conversation moves forwards. And so whether it's myself or Mauro, we're often piled on in that kind of a way, but because that's the role of the writer. And I think as long as we're putting the topic back on the table and doing it in a way that really is quite serious and grounded, then we can push the conversation forward, not just in popular circles, but in academic circles as well.
You get quite a lot of emails and correspondence from people who have experienced things that they can't explain, from subscribers of the channel to army personnel, priests and professors all needing help to process what they've been through. Could you give us some examples of the type of experiences people get in touch with you about?
Well, I hear from a lot of people who have experienced close encounters, and they believe that they are close encounters with ET craft or ET entities, and they have had no one that they can talk to about it. Some people will tell me a story and they'll say, I have told nobody about this since it happened. I was 15 when I had this close encounter. I've told my spouse. I've talked to the person I was with when it happened, and I haven't told another living, breathing soul in the 50 years since it happened. I mean, that's the power of taboo and ridicule, to keep people quiet. But they still need to process what happened, to understand it. I hear from people who've had abduction experiences, abduction and hybridization experiences, and often they'll contact me thinking they're the only person in the world who's had this experience. And I'm able to tell them, no, this is widespread in the present day. And as soon as you start listening to ancestral narratives, it's a story that repeats for thousands of years, a story that comes from every culture on the planet. And at the very least, I can reassure the person that, no, they're not crazy to have this memory or this experience, and that they're actually in very good company. I've heard from a lot of people who are veterans of war, and in particular from US veterans from out of Iraq, people who were part of the 2003 incursion into Iraq. And a lot of those people have come to me and they've said, Paul, what do you know about portals? Because they went into that conflict for all the reasons that we knew about, to effect a regime change, to protect the Kurds from annihilation. And then when they got there, they found their particular unit, oh, weapons of mass destruction was the other reason as well, of course. But when they get there, they find their unit isn't on an archaeological mission. Why were they suddenly collecting archaeological items, sequestering them, shipping them out of the country to Israel or the USA? What was the importance of those items that only a couple of weeks into that incursion, their units were doing that? And so they come back asking questions. What is there that's so important? What is the history of that region? And that takes them to stories from out of ancient Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. And the portals question comes up because the conversation among those who were there is that that was one of the key things. They were there to sequester, or at least to encircle and protect in some kind of a way. And so people ask me, what is the credibility of that? What is the credibility of claims that there would be an ancient portal in Iraq? And I have to tell them, well, I've not been there. I've not been hands-on, I've not been eyes-on, but what I can tell you is that if you listen to ancient narratives, yes, portals figure in our ancestors' stories. If you look at the work of NASA, NASA has been investing millions and millions of dollars into analyzing portals and wormholes for nearly more than 30 years now. And in fact, the Advanced Propulsions Unit has been studying them in detail, studying a portal adjacent to planet Earth, flying around it in their craft, and measuring how much material travels through it when that portal opens up on an eight-minute cycle. That's real. That's real science, and it's in the public domain. You can read about it on the NASA website. So it's real within the realm of science. It's real within the realm of ancestral memory. And when you go to the Sumerian stories and the biblical stories, Yes, Iraq is exactly where you'd expect to find one, because there is one named in Genesis 11 and in the Enuma Elish, the Sumerian story. And so there is great credibility to those claims. And once again, it's not that I can verify what they're saying or prove what they're saying, but I can say, no, you're not crazy to be thinking that. You're actually in very good company, and this has been part of the human story for thousands of years.
Yeah, it does make you wonder where people get the concepts for films like Stargate SG-1.
There is so much real information, I think, in the world of fiction. If you look at the more recent Marvel Universe movies, that is full of Plato. And that's because the writers know Plato and are deliberately retelling the ancient stories. And so there's a lot of that that happens in script writing, where ancient story is very skillfully recycled and retold for a contemporary audience. And Marvel Universe would be one example of that. When you go to Star Trek and Star Wars, you've got that aspect, and then you've also got privileged information that was leaked to some of the script writers. And then you've also got channeled information, information that I believe has come through contact.
What other experiences, what other types of experiences do you hear from people?
Well, there's a phenomenon that some people call a spiritual emergency, or a spiritual emergence, which is where a person suddenly starts experiencing higher cognitive abilities. So they suddenly start experiencing precognition, future viewing, remote viewing, telepathic connection, self-healing ability, or they'll start affecting technology around them without touching it. And I do hear from people who have those experiences who are trying to understand what's happening. Now, some of those experiences can follow close encounters. Sometimes they happen quite on their own. And I tell a story in Echoes of Eden of a guy called Taran, whose house was struck by lightning in Brazil. And the house exploded. And somehow he survived intact, uninjured. He was temporarily blinded by that lightning strike, but he recovered. He was 5 years old when it happened. And from that moment on, he started having experiences, very vivid, clear experiences of precognition. And then on top of that, every so often, he would have this experience of being pulled up out of his body, up into the sky, up into space. And then after what seems like a couple of seconds, he's back in his body, except he's now full of information and understanding that he didn't have before. It's as if he's been pulled out of his body for the next download and then returned into this life. Now, he shared that story with me very hesitantly. He had hardly ever told anybody of his experience before, because who on earth would take that seriously? And when he told me that, I was able to say, Taran, not only do I believe that you are experiencing the things you describe, but there was a whole community of people in medieval France who based their whole lifestyle around that experience and facilitating that experience, not by getting struck by lightning, but by learning to activate their higher faculties. They had this belief that they could download information from cosmic consciousness, because they had followed the work of Plato and the early church fathers who wrote about Plato and some of those gospels and epistles that had been buried in the desert for their protection. They had maintained a tradition of reading those, thinking through the implications. And so they believed that each one of us is a being of consciousness, and that our conscious experience predates our material life and survives it. But that while we're here, we can still download information from our cosmic consciousness. And that picture you described, Taran, of having a cosmic self and an earthly self, and you remain connected all through life, and then occasionally you're reconnected in that experiential way, That is exactly what they wrote about and what they taught about. So once again, it's not that I can verify the experience, but what I can say is people have been experiencing that for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and that the people who did that in medieval France, the Cathars, did it in such a way that it actually lifted their human experience. They were called the Cathars, which meant the good people, because the neighbouring regions of France saw that somehow the Cathars had created a better world. They were living a better life, absent of the high rates of crime and murder that were typical of medieval Europe at that time. And their better lifestyle was derived from this information that they had maintained from these ancient sources. And it was so threatening to the civic and religious status quo that unfortunately the Roman Catholic Church decided they had to be gotten rid of. And so what's arguably the world's first genocide, or the first historical genocide, happened in the Languedoc, with a million people being slaughtered in order to get rid of the information that had empowered that society. So that might seem like a very abstract kind of experience, except it translated into something very concrete and real. And there are people today having these experiences that relate to that, that are having these connections with their higher self or with cosmic information, and they have no framework for it to understand it because these narratives have been silenced. And so in Echoes of Eden, I talk about that and making sense of that.
As well as the one-on-one personal coaching services that you offer to help people process experiences like this, do you have any advice for anyone that might be watching trying to deal with their own experience?
I think it's very hard as long as you're isolated. If there's no one in your immediate friendship or family circle who you think is going to be receptive to hearing from you, it can be very, very hard. I think we're very fortunate to live in an online age where it isn't too difficult to find other people with similar experiences if you go looking. And so the Paul Wallace channel and the Fifth Kind TV on YouTube, I'm in the comments every day, and that's often a meeting place for people who've had these experiences to realize they're not alone, that there are other people out there who've experienced similar things. But having said that, I actually think it would be hard to find a friendship circle or a family circle anywhere that wouldn't have some anomalous story to share. If you ask your friends, have you ever experienced anything that you can't explain, that you've never been able to understand, something mysterious, something anomalous? I reckon every group would have a story. And often it only takes one person to say, well, I experienced this. I don't know what it was, but I'll tell you what I experienced. It only takes one person to give permission to others in the group to say, well, all right, let me tell you something that happened to me. And as people pull their stories of the strange and anomalous, you begin to realize they're not so exceptional after all. And I think it's a matter of learning to give each other permission to share these kinds of stories. Now, it's not every kind of occasion when you can do this, but I reckon that every friendship group has these stories. And we need to encourage each other to share, because as we share our own experiences, I think it will become very clear very quickly that in this world, we are not on our own, that we have company. And I think if we can do that among ourselves, that is a grassroots form of disclosure. That means we don't have to sit around twiddling our thumbs waiting for governments to come clean about ET contact. We can create that wave of disclosure ourselves. So in Echoes of Eden, I talked to a guy called Sean, who is a US Army veteran, who had a close encounter experience that included abduction and abduction for hybridization. And he told his mother and his aunt the morning after the experience, and then for years after that, didn't dare tell another living, breathing soul until he watched me on the Fifth Kind TV and thought, I think I can trust that guy with my story. And his story is so profound and remembered in such detail and is so much a part of this global pattern. I share that story in Echoes of Eden and show how it repeats in cultures including Kenya, Ghana, other countries in Southern Africa, in the Caribbean, in Greece, India, in the Nordic countries. The Welsh and Scottish have versions of this story. In the Philippines, you can go anywhere. And the story that Sean tells repeats detail by detail. And again, I think it's the correlation of details that ought to make any reader think, okay, there is something objective happening here that I need to get my head around.
Many of the ancient texts you mention in Echoes of Eden, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, Oannes and the Apkallu, the Mamiwata people, they all have a reoccurring theme of hybrid beings. Do you think that this could be in any way related to modern contact experiences, as you just mentioned, that report where hybrid babies and things like that are created? Could we currently be in some sort of alien-human hybridization program?
Well, the report that people bring today about abduction and hybridization, and bearing in, just to give a measure of how widespread this might be, not only do you hear this from every culture around the world, but when in the 1990s, US Defense hired John Mack. Now, he was the professor of clinical psychology at Harvard University. So he was the top psychologist they could think of to hire.
They hired him because they wanted to test the mental health of US defense personnel who were reporting abduction experiences. And many of those were abduction for hybridization. And when he went in to study that for them, he found more than 50 people to talk to. That tells you something right away. And the report today is exactly the same as the report of the ancients. Many, many details recurring. Abduction for hybridization. And it seems that there may be a range of ET visitors who are involved in these kinds of programs. So there may be a range of reasons why it's happening. And I think one of the reasons is there may be ET demographics whose gene pool is so depleted, they need to enrich it in this kind of way. But I also think that there's something unique about Homo sapiens, that the blend of Earthling and ET that we are has given us some unique capacities. And I think that our mammal heritage plus our ET advantage has created a species with a unique capacity for love, compassion, creativity, imagination. I think we have more colorful lives than many of our neighbors. And I think some of our neighbors want that in their own gene pool. And certainly when you go to the Genesis 6 story of hybridization, it says explicitly they found Homo sapiens beautiful. They thought the Earth girls were hot. But I think it goes deeper than that. They want some of what we have in their own gene pool. And that's why these programs are going on. And so the stories of hybridization are that people are taken for a while, used for hybridization, and then returned. But the resultant offspring stay with the ET visitors. And that's the clue that it's for their benefit that this is going on.
Do you think that there is a conflict between different groups of ETs over what humanity should be capable of? Or could we be dealing with an inner conflict, perhaps, of one species that have had a bit of a fallout in between themselves?
Definitely. I mean, when Brigadier General Hamer Shedd spoke about an intergalactic federation, he was simply using new language for stories we've heard for thousands of years. The Bible talks about a sky council, and there's a prophet in the Hebrew stories called Micaiah who remote views the sky council. And the Sky Council stories in the Bible echo themes you find in the Norse stories and in the Greek stories that are very clear. There were conflicts among the ET demographics represented on that council. There were different agendas, different ideas about, for instance, what the human population should be on planet Earth, different agendas for how long they should live. And then there are conflicts over hegemony and resources, and humanity gets caught in the crossfire. I think the reason that council is there is to moderate these different demographics who each have a hand in Project Earth and who don't see eye to eye as to what should be happening. I think that's the same now as it ever was. I think it might not be visible to us, but our ancestors said you cannot possibly understand what's happening on planet Earth until you realize there is a non-human layer to the governance of humanity.
What would you say to people who think that aliens, UFOs, and anything to do with ET contact, they generally put it down to a demonic phenomenon?
Well, that really was my position. When I was deep in the world of Christian ministry, I had a worldview that had boxes for God, the devil, angels, demons, humans, animal, vegetable, mineral, and nothing else. And so when I was 20, I had five anomalous experiences, three of which at least were close encounter experiences. But I didn't describe them that way, and I didn't understand them that way, because I didn't really believe in that kind of thing. I had to force them into one of those boxes. And so the experience that was scary, well, that had to be demonic. The experience that was elevating, well, that had to be angelic. And it's really only since I've done the research that's produced the Eden series that I look back and think, no, those experiences don't fit those boxes at all. That scary experience was a close encounter of the fourth kind. That elevating experience, close encounter of the fourth kind. And very often in my coaching, I find people who've had experiences they've never been able to understand or explain, and it's only decades later that they're giving themselves permission to find the language for it of close encounter, UFO encounter, ET contact. So I would say that. And then I would also say, just remember, this has been authenticated now by the Pentagon. The UFO phenomenon is real, they tell us. And in fact, US defense operations are interfered with on average every 6 weeks by UFO phenomena. That was what was in the Senate briefing paper of 2021. So there's no reason to be skeptical and debunking in that kind of way. People call these experiences demonic, I think because they're taboo, they're frightening, and they don't realize there are other boxes you can tick. I think this is one of the reasons that more than a decade ago, the Roman Catholic Church had the Pontifical Academy of Sciences convene a symposium, what they called a colloquium, to discuss the theological implications of contact with other civilizations. And representatives for Pope Benedict XVI, the most conservative pope in my lifetime, met the press and said, we should be willing to talk about ET beings, a wider cosmic family. We should expect to be in contact. We shouldn't be surprised when it happens. We should be ready to embrace them as a brother or sister alien. And we shouldn't be surprised to meet them because they're in the Bible. They're in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And in that moment, the Roman Catholic Church was giving people permission to talk about their close encounter experiences, to talk about what they were seeing in the texts. And significantly, there was a guy, Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who was the Vatican's senior advisor in paranormal ministry. Now, what that usually means is entity removal, exorcisms, deliverance ministry. And he said, when people report close encounters, we shouldn't describe it as demonic, because it's actually a totally different kind of entity. A close encounter isn't a demonic encounter, and it's not some kind of psychological phenomenon. It is a totally different kind of entity that people are encountering, one that merits serious study. So you've got these authorities saying, no, these are real phenomena, and we should be able to talk about them seriously.
Do you think that the teachings of Jesus and Christianity are compatible with ETs?
Well, I think mainstream orthodoxy really struggles with it. But I think as soon as you go back to the texts and do translation work, it's very hard to avoid it. I agree with Guy Consolmagno that there is ET contact in Old Testament and New Testament alike, whether you're looking at the conception narratives around Jesus and John the Baptist or of Isaac in the Old Testament. We're looking at close encounter phenomena. We're reading about technology. We're reading about wormholes, craft, other life forms. So it's all there in the root texts. It was there in the conversation of early Christianity. So it's entirely possible. I find that my understanding of God and Jesus has only been enlightened and expanded by my research into paleo contact. I think if you want to hold on to all the dogmas of institutional Christianity, then you might struggle a bit. But if you're willing to go back to the roots and read the texts and reread the Old Testament and the New Testament, reread the story of Jesus, you'll realize that paleo contact illuminates this story, and that the story of Jesus is part of a wide family of stories explaining who we are and what is possible for you and me as human beings.
Yeah, because as you mentioned before in some of your other books, it does seem like Jesus did distance himself a little bit from the Orthodox teachings.
He absolutely did. He distanced himself from the Hebrew scriptures as they were translated at that time. That's why in Acts 15, the early church decided that faith in the Old Testament or faith in the Hebrew stories was not going to be requisite for Christianity moving forward. They could only make that decision because they could see that Jesus had distanced himself from those stories. And there are some very emphatic moments when it's clear that Jesus was not into the Yahweh stories as God's stories. And there's a very pointed moment I talk about in Echoes of Eden where Jesus really repudiates the Yahweh stories as in any way representing the God that he was teaching and interacting with.
In your new book, Echoes of Eden, you touch upon some experiences that you've had personally, some psychic experiences with remote viewing and things like that. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you experienced?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll say that higher cognitive abilities like remote viewing, future viewing, telepathic connection, self-healing, those are all part of the cultural story of the cultures who tell stories about paleo contact. So you listen to ancestral narratives, they'll talk about ancient ET contact and higher cognitive abilities. These themes completely interwoven. And so when you go to a traditional healer or to a shaman, they will often have protocols for achieving exactly those higher abilities. I have had my own experiences of this, and for a long time, again, I interpreted it in a Christian way. So I've had a number of remote viewing experiences which I described as a word of knowledge. And in my Christian framework, this is where God gives a piece of information to a Christian worker in order to help the person they're ministering to. But then I started having experiences that didn't fit that paradigm at all. So, for instance, I had a phone call from a guy who wanted to come and perform at my church. And as I started speaking to him on the phone, I knew exactly what he looked like. I knew his height, his build, the color of his eyes, the color of his hair, so accurately that when randomly he walked into somebody else's house a couple of weeks later, I recognized him because I'd remote viewed him. Around about the same time, I had an experience of we were going to redecorate the outside of our house so that we could sell it. And I went into a realtor's office and I said, "Do you know any companies who do this?" And the agent said, "Oh, actually, my husband is a painter. I could give you his card." And as she spoke to me, I saw her husband in my mind's eye. I knew how tall he was. I knew his build. I knew the style and color of his hair. I knew how he walked. So much so that, again, when I randomly saw him a couple of weeks later, I recognized him from what I'd seen in my mind's eye. So these were much more random experiences that had nothing to do with facilitating Christianity in some missionary kind of way. And I began wondering if this was actually a higher cognitive ability that was flashing on. I think these kind of experiences are widespread. I think many, many people have flashes of precognition, flashes of remote viewing, flashes of telepathic connection, clues that we have these abilities that can possibly be nurtured. And there is a serious field of neuroscience that is called acquired savant syndrome. This is a syndrome studied by peer-reviewed scientists all around the world in which higher cognitive abilities are switched on by accident through a head impact, a brain injury, a central nervous system event. And people awake from a coma or after a stroke, suddenly they can speak a language they couldn't speak before. Or they have phenomenal skills in mathematics or higher physics. Or they can play a musical instrument they couldn't play before. And these scientists ask, first of all, what does it mean that people have these higher cognitive abilities in the off position until there's an accident? And is there a way of accessing them without a brain injury? And ancient cultures say absolutely. That's what their shamanic and mystical protocols are all about, switching these back on. So having studied these in the past, in ancestral narratives, it readied me to recognize it in the present day. And I had an amazing experience with a six-year-old who was doing remote viewing right in front of me, remote viewing something that was hidden under the desk of someone we were talking to online who was in a completely different country. And the moment I saw that was the moment I thought, okay, I need to invest some time into studying the legitimacy of this, not only in shamanic practice, but for you and me. There was a 25-year period where the USA had a remote viewing program that was oversighted ultimately by the CIA, and the Stanford Research Institute curated it. And it was all about remote viewing for strategic intelligence advantage. The reason the USA opened this department up was because they discovered that the Soviet Union had a remote viewing department. And they knew that the Soviet Union wasn't into woo-woo, spirituality, mysticism. They would only be investing their precious dollars into that program if it was yielding them some kind of strategic advantage. And in the period of the Cold War, there was no way the US would allow Russia to have a strategic advantage over anything. So they developed their own program, and it ran for all that time. I think it was five successive presidential administrations kept refunding the program because it was yielding useful information. Ingo Swann was part of that program. He's the guy who remote viewed the rings of Jupiter. I think it was 9 months ahead of the photos coming in from Voyager when we saw the rings for the first time. Nobody knew about the rings. No one had theorized about the rings, but Ingo Swann had seen them. And then the year following, Pat Price remote viewed the location where the heiress Patty Hearst was being held. She'd been kidnapped. And then the year after that, they used remote viewing to locate a downed Russian jet in Zaire that all their intelligence technology couldn't find. And so they used a remote viewer to give them the longitude and latitude coordinates of the crashed jet. And they found it. And we've heard President Carter speaking openly about it. So it's a real world phenomenon. Why is it debunked in public? Well, I think governments are going to want to use this to spy on others. They don't want to be spied on. You know, the US want to spy on Soviet Union. They don't want to be spied on by them. And they certainly don't want a general public who can remote view classified documents on a minister's desk. And so it serves government interests for the public to believe this is ridiculous, it's been discredited, it's been debunked, while actually government is secretly practicing it behind closed doors. And that's always been the pattern. It was the same in the 1500s when Queen Elizabeth I was laying the foundations of British intelligence. She hired John Dee because she wanted a remote viewing department. John Dee was one of the top academics of the day. Now, if he had been caught remote viewing for members of the public, he would have been in a witchcraft trial and he would have been executed. But because he was doing it for the crown, well, that was a different story. And so it's a very, very similar pattern. It was maintained in the US until chief of staff came in who was of a more fundamentalist brand, theologically speaking, and he didn't want anything like remote viewing under his oversight because he felt it was demonic. We're back to having too few boxes to tick. And so officially it was shut down, although I think the reality is they simply subcontracted to other groups to maintain that program for them. And the story in the UK was very similar, that once Queen Elizabeth I had died and James IV of Scotland, James I of England came in, the program was shut down because James I of England was a more fundamentalist kind of Christianity, didn't want anything that even smelt of something demonic or something that he might consider witchcraft. And so John Dee was out on his ear as well, and it was shut down. So it's very interesting that that bias, that assumption that there's something nefarious or demonic about remote viewing was useful in terms of keeping the public away from it, but unfortunately came back to bite the programs and had them shut down. Nevertheless, I believe those programs are still going on for intelligence around the world because of its strong record in yielding information with a strategic value.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, I wonder if that is the case, it's still going on. You can almost imagine like an X-Men type school for people with special abilities. I wonder if that sort of thing is actually happening and we just don't know about it.
Well, it's funny because there was a moment in the US program when a chief of staff came in who was a little bit more skeptical, and he just wanted to test how clever the remote viewers were in the remote viewing department. And so they brought in some members of the public who were not remote viewers. They were generally fairly closely involved in government anyway, to give them some experiments. And it was discovered they could do it as well. Yeah. And so, again, that hints at the probability that we all have this ability and that it can be nurtured.
Yeah, definitely. Could you tell us a bit about your research into the Hermetic texts that you touch upon in your book?
Well, I was intrigued to discover the Hermetic texts because one of the sources of information that Plato names is ancient Egyptian information that has come through a Greek tradition. And it's the fusion of Egyptian esoteric knowledge and Greek esoteric knowledge. It's from that world that we get the Hermetic texts. And that is a wisdom tradition that, again, is rooted in contact experiences. At least that's the way it's written up. And it's a tradition that talks about us accessing other dimensions and other dimensions of ourselves. So that Cathar idea of you have a cosmic self and an earth self and you can connect the two, that really comes from a Hermetic source as well. And even though it's quite a controversial tradition and it got pushed out of mainstream Christianity, it survived. And when you get to the Renaissance, you've got some very significant figures who invested a lot of time into those texts, people like Giordano Bruno, who read up on those texts and then translated them into practical protocols for heightening consciousness and heightening the power of the mind. And unfortunately, at that time, it was still a time when that information was unwelcome. And Giordano Bruno ended up getting executed because he was giving his information not to kings and queens like John Dee was, not to the Pope only, but to the general public. And this was deemed dangerous information. So it mirrors really what happened to Socrates back in the day, who was giving his information to the general public about heightening their intelligence, their consciousness. He believed if we did that, then we could improve the political life of the world because things would have to change. Giordano Bruno was attempting the same thing and got executed for it. And his convictions and information had come from the Hermetic tradition.
Armed papal officers stand at the street corners, encouraging the crowds to cheer as the object is dragged before them into the market square. The object is a naked man. He has been in prison for 7 years. Few would recognize him as the charismatic scholar and speaker who had dazzled Europe only a few years before with his speaking tours. a friar of the Dominican order, his public demonstrations of phenomenal mental skills and his books on mental self-improvement and mnemonics had made him a popular figure in a Europe hungry for new ideas. Now, he is an object of horror. The papal guards unchain the man and fix him on a stake, upside down. One guard now pulls the man's tongue forward out of his mouth and nails it to the stake. Next, he draws a knife from its scabbard and uses it to sever the man's tongue. Other officers of the church now step forward to ignite the pyre positioned below the man's head. The crowd watches in fearful approval as Giordano Bruno goes up in flames. It is Ash Wednesday. Giordano Bruno had been held in prison for 7 years without trial in the vain hope that he might recant his heretical ideas. Such a recantation would break the spell of his popularity among a public who had flocked to his lectures and demonstrations of mental skills. It would serve as a warning to Christians throughout Europe not to stray too far from Catholic orthodoxy. In the absence of a recantation, a trial has been hurried through to allow for his public execution, which will send shockwaves through Christendom for decades to come and leave people in no doubt that the ideas of Giordano Bruno are ideas to be avoided at every possible cost.
There seems to be a concerted effort in a lot of areas to keep buried ancient texts and indigenous narratives. As you mentioned before, sometimes in really brutal and inhumane ways, especially during like the periods of colonization. Could you elaborate a bit more on why you think this happens? What is so dangerous about these ancient narratives that they have to be so forcefully buried?
I think that any government wants full spectrum dominance over its population. Any government wants to be the arbiter of what's true, not true, what's news and what's fake news, and especially if it's a new government or a force that's invaded and colonized another country. If you say there was no massacre in that square, then you don't want other news agencies saying there was, or you don't want other authorities bringing another story. If you go and take over a country, you want to provide the education and the science. You don't want the local priesthoods or local authorities contradicting you at every turn. If you want to be the source of information about life, the universe and everything, you don't want people having direct contact experiences with powerful entities saying, no, that's not true, this is the case. It's just not going to be welcome anywhere. So when the Portuguese and Spanish went into Central and South America, they executed the nobles, the royals and the priesthoods so that there would be no other authority present. And they incinerated the written heritage of those cultures so that the only information would be Catholic information. And that's happened the world over. Sometimes it happens in more subtle ways. So when Britain went into Ghana, for instance, between 1874 and 1950, it didn't do those things, though it had been equally brutal in other places. But it did shame those other authorities into silence. The idea was that if you were going to get on in British Ghana, then you would look British, think British, act British, dress British, and then you look like a good candidate for a good job, promotion, etc. So if you had a mother or a grandmother who had not fully bought into the British ways and who still was doing old religion, contact, protocols, oh, that's a witch doctor, that's an idol worshipper. And that sort of dark, demonizing language was done to make you ashamed of your own heritage so that you would buy in to the British imperial model. And that's how it was done there, so that people would be embarrassed to take seriously the old ways. And you've got a whole spectrum in between those two things. But it's been very deliberate, very conscious, very intentional. If you look at what happened in Australia, Canada, and the USA, there was a 100-year period, the same period, across those three countries. Between 1880 and 1980, a concerted effort to eradicate the information of the indigenous peoples. There was a stolen generation policy where children would be taken forcibly from their parents so they couldn't be brought up in their indigenous ways. They'd be brought up in boarding schools and have Christian orthodoxy drilled into them. And now we've got a truth and reconciliation process in Canada because we realize how brutal that regime was. 150,000 First Nation Canadian children kidnapped and effectively imprisoned in youth detention centers for reprogramming. And more than 10,000 of those were murdered by the nuns and the priests who supposedly were educating them. That is what has surfaced, and more of that information has surfaced while I've been writing Echoes of Eden. And the Truth and Reconciliation process has concluded this was a deliberate attempt at cultural genocide. They wanted the whole culture to stop, and they wanted to stop information that those cultures had curated, and they wanted to stop higher cognitive abilities that were nurtured by those cultures. That's why the first thing you do, apparently, to a First Nation Canadian child when you kidnap them at the age of six and you imprison them, is you shave off all their hair, because you know that hair is very important to the shamanic abilities of those people. It's got nothing to do with education. You don't need to shave people's hair off to make them Christians, but they were doing it to cut them off from their culture and from information. In the USA, the initiation ceremonies that passed this information and these skills on from generation to generation were illegalized for 100 years to try and put a stop to it. So those are just examples of the governments wanting to silence the voice of these other cultures. It didn't discontinue them as a people group, but it wanted all the information and understanding that they carried to be stopped so that people today would not be able to do what their ancestors could do and would not know what their ancestors knew.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic that people would do things like that in the name of God and you know, Christianity.
And I'm afraid that that is the case. It was governments hand in glove with church authorities. So in the USA, in Canada, and in Australia, it was the churches that ran the youth detention centres, which were brutal and, as I say, sometimes murderous. So there is a very shameful, dark aspect of history in that. But it's only one iteration of a pattern that is ages old, where stories of paleo contact and higher cognitive abilities are suppressed because it makes for a more easily managed population.
While you was writing Echoes of Eden, what do you think some of the most important elements that you found while you were researching for the book? Is there anything in particular that stands out to you?
Yes, I think realizing, once again, correlations among cultures all around the world, that if you go to a traditional healer in Central or South America, or in Southern Africa or West Africa, or in England, if you go for healing, you will suddenly realize that you are involved in protocols that are actually about contact, that are brokering interdimensional contact in order to tap information that will support you in your journey. Now, I didn't know that until I did the research for Echoes of Eden, but it is a pattern that is global. And then I began to realize that pattern is in primitive Christianity as well. And so I think it's one thing to read a story from one place that implies that we can switch on remote viewing, future viewing, telepathic connection, self-healing, but to realize that our ancestors all around the world are unanimous about this, that there are ways of doing this, that we can live more healthily, more intelligently, more consciously, and have a better human experience on planet Earth. The more you hear it repeating, the more you think there's something in this, and I want to find out what it is, and I want to put it to work. And so I think Echoes of Eden really goes to the so what of paleo contact, the so what of this wider worldview. And I think people will come away with things they can do that will impact their own lives on planet Earth.
We've mentioned before how important it could potentially be, the mistranslations of these ancient texts. Just imagine if all the conflicts and wars and things about different religions are all based on a story that's been misinterpreted for so long.
Well, unfortunately, I think that there is truth in that. Because we've read stories of brutal colonization and ill treatment of human beings as a story of God and God's behavior, we've come up with a picture of God that is completely distorted. Rather than thinking of God as the cosmic source, I mean, the Apostle Paul described God as the source of the cosmos and everything in it, that in which we all live and move and have our being. I think that's a beautiful image of God. But you go to the mistranslation of the Elohim stories and you've got a God who's brutal, violent, punitive, can turn on a dime, can genocide people, will slaughter people who are actually trying to serve him, will torment people who are trying to serve him. It's a monstrous deity we've created by mistranslation. And you can draw a straight line from that to all kinds of violence and abuses that we've justified in the name of God. If you worship a God who will do genocide, you will justify genocide. If you worship a God who's xenophobic, then you will become a xenophobe. And I think all kinds of enslavements, colonization, violence, misogyny has been justified through the ages because we're going off a totally wrong idea of what God is. And that comes down to mistranslation. You know, when I talk about Bible translation, people might say, well, that's a bit of a rarefied topic, isn't it? But the implications of getting it wrong are enormous, and they have been through the ages. And that's part of my sense of urgency in doing the translation work, that people should realize that God is the source of the cosmos. You don't even have to use the word God, because I think it's so unhelpful. People layer onto that word centuries of religious entrainment and dogma. So often I prefer just to talk about the source of the cosmos, the cosmic source. I think we really need to deconstruct this violent, horrible image of God that leaves so many people anxious and tiptoeing around, desperate they're not going to mistake his will or offend him. There's a huge psychological relief that we owe to one another by realizing the Elohim stories are not God's stories. They are stories of paleo contact. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm persisting in my field of research and putting books out to open this whole topic of ancient e-contact, ET contact, to a wider readership.
Yeah, well, you're definitely doing a very good job. The Eden series is phenomenal. I recommend it to anyone. And your latest book, Echoes of Eden, is such a good read. I'm sure you're going to have lots of people sending you emails and comments about that for a long time to come. What impact, if any, has publishing your work had on you, your family and your social life? Has it changed you in any way? Has it had a difference?
Well, I remember researching Escaping from Eden. So that's the first in the series. There's Escaping from Eden, then The Scars of Eden, then Echoes of Eden. And I was researching Escaping from Eden, and I remember the feeling of the floor falling away from me a couple of times as my worldview shifted a little bit. And then one evening in particular, I was thinking, how many friends am I going to lose by publishing this book? Because I realized it would be difficult for a lot of people to do business with. But I felt, no, it's too important for all the reasons I've just said. I can't learn this and not share it. It is too important to keep it a secret. I couldn't live with that. I've got to share this information. But how many friends am I going to lose? And having asked the question, a couple of hours later, I was watching somebody being interviewed. And from out of the blue, they said, of course, you will lose some friends, but you will gain thousands of others who are so grateful for what you're saying and what you're contributing. You'll gain heaps of other friends. And it was as if he had heard my question and was answering it. I thought, thank you, the cosmos. Thank you, the universe. That is the answer. Well, sure enough, yes, my social life has become a little bit quieter since publishing the Eden series, but I have gained friends all around the world who are in the same territory as me, who are in the same field of research, who have had certain experiences. And so there has been a shift. There have been some friendships become a little bit quieter than before. Maybe if I was applying for church jobs, it might be a bit more of a struggle than it was before. And my whole pattern of making a living has had to change because of it. But to be honest, I wouldn't exchange this journey for the world. It's been an incredible relief to me at a psychological level to open up to a wider universe, have a more expanded understanding of God and Jesus, of myself, of what we're all capable of. And I feel I'm on a very exciting journey of exploration. And that's what I'm sharing in the books. So there's been some cost to publishing it, but I would rather be a truth seeker than someone who just sticks forever to dogmas they signed up to when they were 25. And I find the exploration exciting and life-giving.
Endorsed by George Norrie and Eric Von Daniken, Paul Wallace's latest book, Echoes of Eden, explores what secrets of human potential were buried with our ancestors' memories of ET contact. From Senate briefings in Washington, D.C., to secret ceremonies in Southern Africa, from strange phenomena in Australia and Iraq, to mysterious encounters in modern Brazil and ancient Greece. Echoes of Eden will take you around the globe to discover why military, intelligence, and other government agencies are so interested in archaeology, indigenous rituals, and traditional initiation practices. What is the connection between higher cognitive powers like remote viewing and precognition and ET contact in the deep past? And what are the implications for us today? Echoes of Eden, out now. Available on Amazon. Follow the links in the description.
Go to www.paulanthonywallace.com for information about Paul and his books.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content.